No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and we hope together that our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. Maria, hello. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, staying safe. Yeah, I mean, in California, as many of you know, I'm in Washington, D.C., but Maria's in beautiful California. What's left of it these days?
Los Angeles, yeah. It was 106 on Friday.
Wow.
Yeah.
And tonight we have a very special guest with us. We have Brittany Kaiser, who's best known as the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower. She is the co-founder of Own Your Own Data Foundation. She's also the co-founder of the Digital Asset Trade Association, DATA, a nonprofit lobbying firm advancing legislative reform, protecting the rights of individuals to control their own digital assets. She is the primary subject of a Netflix original documentary, The Great Hack, and everybody out there listening should see this film. It's amazing. It premiered at the 2019 Sundance Film Festival, and she's the author of Targeted. And we're so excited to have her tonight because there's so much I didn't know about Facebook. And so welcome to the show, Ms. Kaiser. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Such a pleasure to be here. Really honored to receive the invitation and to have the opportunity to talk about what I believe is one of the world's most important issues that we're facing right now, which is our lack of data rights. That's why I call myself a data rights activist.
Well, you know, in the film, obviously that becomes obvious, but let's start right there at the beginning. You know, as I told you when we talked earlier, you know, I thought Facebook was a platform to show videos of your kittens playing and to brag about your kids graduating from high school, but it's a lot more than that, is it not?
Well, I think you're right that most social media platforms were originally designed as platforms to connect us, to find a way to not just peer-to-peer be able to communicate, but to be able to create communities about things we care about, and therefore actually have more connection in our lives, be able to get the word out about issues that are important to us. You know, I saw that in the very beginning when I first got into technology in 2007 when I joined the first Obama campaign, where we invented social media strategy. And at the time, it really was just that. It was a platform for finding a way to connect people and to be able to start to mobilize activism. You know, I've always been a political animal, and I really think that in the beginning, social media was an incredible opportunity for people that would have never met before or never been able to organize together to be able to do that. All of a sudden, we saw mass amounts of people registering to vote for the first time, getting involved and engaging in issues that maybe they had never thought about before, finding ways to directly connect with politicians so that they could talk about what was important to them and their families. And so, you know, you could call me naive or you could call me an eternal optimist, which is what I prefer, of course. But I really did see exactly what you saw. You know, it's an opportunity to communicate and that there isn't a bad side. That's what I thought for quite a few years.
And Brittany, I'm really glad that you made that distinction, because I truly am under the impression that it didn't start out with nefarious intent, that it was about, and I one of the reasons that I didn't join in right away is I'm already close to the people I'm close to. Why do I need to go on and find somebody that I went to grade school with or what had my first job with or whatever? But I guess what happened, and maybe you can speak to this, because of course it always boils down to profit and the almighty dollar. Someone found out that by harvesting our data, they could make money and they could charge people for that data. And that's where we as the consumer are missing out, that our clicks, our likes, our whatevers are being harvested and sold.
And you're exactly right. So as these different social media platforms began to develop and become more popular, now internal company strategy was thinking about how do we monetize this?
Mm-hmm.
And it was only when these platforms started to be monetized where the people implementing those strategies thought, well, hey, the more data we can collect about people, the more we can sell to them. And, you know, we have to be very honest with ourselves, which is that most technology products that have developed over the past many decades have been specifically designed to take as much of our data as possible. And now it depends whether a company is trying to, you know, sell you a new brand of toothpaste or whether the organization is meaning to change your opinion about how you're going to vote in an election, that mm-hmm. it starts to really get a little bit more controversial. What data is being collected about us? We have no transparency into that. Which hands is it getting into? Who actually gets access to this? What are they allowed to use it for? And unfortunately, since the past decade of social media absolutely exponentially blossoming around the world, means that we now have billions of people where their data is being collected from them every single day, and mm-hmm. none of us have any control over what's going to be done with that. And this is now a multi-trillion dollar industry. Our data is now the most valuable asset on planet Earth. So this has become more of an arms race instead of just, an entrepreneurial activity that was seeking to connect us and make a better world. This is now, a kleptocratic system that is meant to take away as much value from us as possible in order to profit off of it.
And well, so, Michael, ahead, just Maria. Pardon me for one second. So, Brittany, I need to let you know something. I have my master's degree in media psychology, and I'm getting my PhD in media psychology, and we're studying artificial intelligence and immersive reality and augmented reality and virtual reality. So I'm a little bit more aware than the average bear, if you will. So some of my questions probably are going to hit you ridiculously sideways, like Kate Crawford and Dana Boyd. Those are two of mm-hmm. my role models. And that might be some people, women, that the ordinary person wouldn't know. We can get into that a little bit later if you don't mind. But what I find particularly egregious about the United States of America and the Silicon Valley in particular is that we don't have set up, California is, but we don't have what the EU does, which the General Data Protection Regulation, also known as the GDPR. And why?
Yeah, exactly. I am still wondering why.
Do you want to let
why.
Everybody know what that means, what it is?
Absolutely.
Because it passed, it went into effect in May of 2018 in the EU, and we don't have it here.
Exactly. So on May 25th, 2018, GDPR went into enactment, as you said, the General Data Protection Regulation. And the EU had been working on that for very many years. So this was something that, in general, because of the way that a lot of EU laws are structured, they're meant to protect citizens as opposed to enable companies to have unchecked innovation. And that's, in general, just what their legal framework normally looks like. So for GDPR, first of all, what's most important is that it allowed people in Europe to only opt in if they want their data to be collected. Data could not be collected without an opt-in. In America, it's the opposite. Because we have no national legislation like GDPR, it means we are pre-opted in and our data is mm-hmm. always collected, completely mm-hmm. unchecked, without us having any rights to opt out in any easy manner. As you mentioned, the California Consumer Privacy Act, which came into enactment this January 1st only, still only technically protecting Californians and not anyone else in the rest of the United States, regardless of whether or not some companies are deciding to apply it nationally. It does only legally protect Californians, right? So the rest of the United States, and even California, we have to go through a complex opt-out process if we choose to, and only people in California really have the right to completely opt out. So there's other important parts of GDPR that I think are important for people to understand, which is that it applies to any organization that is holding data on EU citizens. Now, CCPA in California is only applying to companies that do at least $24 million in revenue or hold the personal data of at least 50,000 people. So that can easily not include nonprofit entities like 501c4s or advocacy groups. That can easily not include small and medium-sized companies. And so that's a huge concern right now that we're dealing with even the most progressive legislation that we have in the U.S. on these topics. With GDPR, it gives citizens the right to access any data that's being held on them, the right to delete or correction, or to object to that data being automatically processed, as well as the right to an automatic notification of a data breach. And there's 1 month allowed for an organization to respond to a request for that data or for a right to erase or to a citizen requesting or revoking access to using their data for marketing. So it's pretty clear. It's not fully comprehensive. Obviously, it still needs some work, but it was a really good first step. And somehow, even though this has happened, you know, over 2 years ago, in the United States, somehow, all national bills that have been proposed relating to data protection and privacy have not been able to get off the floor. So I think we have a huge issue right now, not just with this being made a partisan issue, which it shouldn't be made. There are some legislators that believe that this is either more conservative or more progressive, but it's not either. It's just about protecting people's basic human rights. We've always had a human right to privacy, but not really the national legislation in order to ratify those international agreements. And I think that's what we're really talking about here, is how do we actually ratify the laws that we've already agreed to uphold?
You know, I've got to tell you, after watching The Great Hack, I was very surprised at my naivete, because I used to be one of the directors of direct mail for the Democratic National Committee, and this was always our approach. I remember that we had a thing called the Campaign to Save Social Security, where we sent out our direct mail in brown craft envelopes with a document inside with your name and address that looked like a Social Security check. And this was brought up before a committee in Congress about how deceitful and deceptive it was that we were making people think we were sending them Social Security checks. When you open the envelope, what we did was slam the Republicans for their stand on Social Security. So it surprises me that we weren't more aware of the downside of this right from the get-go, because this has always been our motivation. But let me ask you, the speed, this is a whole new animal. The speed at which it moves is incredible. I've had three election night parties at a place called Comet Pizza here in Washington, D.C. My part-time assistant was a bartender there, and it's at the center of a thing called Pizzagate, which still goes on to this day. I can't believe I saw this. I also watched a documentary called The Social Dilemma, and they're still talking about Pizzagate when it's been totally debunked. How does this stuff move so quickly? And become so
pervasive?
I think
that's one of the biggest problems that we're facing right now, is that with the rise of data-driven digital marketing, that this is an exponential problem from what we could formerly say we were dealing with direct mail or even with phone calls or anything like that. now everyone is actually able to be completely bombarded all day long on the screens that I would say today most people are spending an average of at least 8 hours a day being completely exposed to anyone who has paid enough money to put an advertisement in front of someone. And it's not just that they've paid to put an advertisement in front of someone. They have designed an advertisement that is meant to persuade you to do something specific. And it is being shown to you because you are shown to be someone that is likely to take an action or change their mind once they see that type of communication. So now instead of sending one advertisement, I can send 10,000 different advertisements that all say something different. And this is very dangerous in politics because a politician could actually have 10,000 different opinions on one topic, and no one would ever know that because they're only going to see the advertisement that is targeted directly at them.
And it doesn't have to have a shred of truth. I mean, the Pizzagate thing, for example, doesn't have a shred of truth in it. There is no basement. There is no ring of pedophiles. It's just a regular kind of family restaurant. In fact, when it came out, the patrons were so outraged that they had to close the restaurant for a few weeks that they just poured money into it to keep it open because they were so outraged because there wasn't a shred of truth in it. And that's what really gets me is you don't have to say anything that's real. You can make it all up. Is that not right?
QAnon.
Right. We have no regulation of this at all.
Well, what I think is the biggest problem is that we do have legislation and regulation around slander and libel. We have legislation and regulation over incitement of violence and racism and voter suppression. We already have laws that prevent a lot of this from happening in our day-to-day lives. Yet somehow we have not found a way to police this in the same way that we would if this were happening physically in someone's neighborhood. We don't have the ability to do that in our digital lives. So,
but Brittany, may I take you to a question here? We do have the ability to, but we're not. For example, we have the FCC.
Right.
Like, why aren't we? Facebook, Google... you know, LinkedIn. I mean, they're media. Just because they're on the internet, I don't understand why we as Americans distinguish them from other activities that we do police and we do enforce and we do fine and we do sanction.
I completely agree with you. This is one of the biggest conversations that I have with media executives, who are absolutely horrified at what's going on. Not only are they real news organizations that have spent at minimum decades building up a legitimate staff that do fact checking, that don't cite single anonymous sources, that are not allowed to lie to the public, that are not allowed to print disinformation or fake news, and that they would be criminally prosecuted if they did. And all of a sudden their entire business is being undermined by platforms that are allowing people to publish absolutely anything, even if it would normally be against the law. And we're only starting to see platforms like Twitter or Facebook flagging content or deleting content. This is the first election cycle where we're actually seeing this happen. And it's happening, unfortunately, as far as we can tell, on a much smaller scale than is actually required to say that our elections are free and fair. Just like the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, the amount of disinformation that is going on social media platforms right now is exponentially worse than 2016, especially given that during this pandemic time that most people are leading a completely digital life for the first time and are much more vulnerable to seeing more of this targeted content than they ever have been before. So really thinking about, are we going to allow these platforms to continue to be exempt from the types of regulations that we hold media companies to? I mean, I don't think that that is something we should continue to allow. I understand that their argument is more, we are companies that are allowing people to their right to free speech. But you know what? I'm a trained human rights lawyer. I know a lot about free speech, and that is not an unchecked right. My right to free speech ends where your human rights begin, and I do not have the right to incite violence upon you or slander or libel you or to suppress your vote. But somehow,
or say fire in a movie theater. You can't even do that.
Exactly. So I think the massive outcry from certain groups of society saying that the regulation of social media is censorship is a completely nonsensical argument and has no place in our actual legal system.
Well, you know, this is a good segue. In order to bring me out of the 18th century and into the 21st century of technology, Mrs. Brown has bought me a Apple Watch. And I'm telling you, just as you were talking about this, Brittany, I got a thing from Fox News that says social media erupts over Biden's big tech ties after Facebook and Twitter censor New York Post story on Hunter Biden. Now, that's exactly what you're talking about, right? They attempted to block what they see as disinformation, and now progressives are upset about it because they see it as a violation of our First Amendment rights. So any ideas how we get around that conundrum?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a few different things. One is that I actually think that companies like Facebook, for example, that are worth over $500 billion, need to spend a much more significant budget on content moderation. Right now, Mark Zuckerberg likes to brag that he has thousands of people working on it. Well, when you have billions of people on a platform, only having thousands of people working on this is not enough. You could take a big chunk of budget and you could put it towards this and protect a lot more people around the world from abuse. It's very possible. The problem is that these companies only have duties to their shareholders and have no fiduciary responsibility to their users. And that is absolutely horrific given that their entire value is all our personal data. So they really are custodians of our personal information. And they're using it just to profit for their shareholders as opposed to protect us as citizens and us as their users. And that needs to change.
And so, Brittany, could we get to the origins of what it is that we're speaking of? Because our consumerism is being harvested, as we said, and monetized. But there's something, and please explain to our listeners, there's something known as a digital footprint, which is also what we're being monetized by, and then a digital shadow. And will you let our users know what it is that we are creating on a daily basis with what pages we view and what Google searches we engage in and what we like?
I could tell you, by scratching the surface, that nearly every single thing that you do is being recorded. Every step that you take, everything you read, everything you search for, how long you are looking at a certain photo or advertisement, everyone that you're texting and calling, the movements that you are using even just to walk around in your personal home, every little thing that you are doing is creating data sets. And every single day, we're using more applications, we're using more technology, and therefore we're creating exponentially more data every single day. So when we say a digital footprint, what we really mean is that you are actually making, your data sets are an imprint of every single thing that you do, every move you make, every purchase you make, even just reading the newspaper at night, if you're reading it digitally, they know how many seconds it's taken you to read each sentence and what pictures are more interesting to you because you've decided to pause before scrolling. So it's really every single thing. And when we say that you're really creating, you might have heard the term digital profiles or audience groups or shadow profiles, as you said. The word shadow profile more often actually means that for instance, even if you don't have a Facebook account, Facebook has a massive data set on you, because every person that you are connected with in your phone book, or that you've ever called or texted or interacted with or had a meeting with, that data is still triangulating, saying that you are a network connection of this person, that you guys have sat in a room together, you know, having dinner at a restaurant, or you've gone shopping together, you've done business meetings together. And therefore, Facebook has all of this data about you, even though you haven't created a profile. So the extent of the data industry is that every piece of technology you're using, from your phone to your laptop to every application, every platform you log into, every web browser, that is creating so much data about you that's going on a multi-trillion dollar market, that companies that you are not even a customer of have nearly as much data about you as companies that you actually interact with. And so therefore, this amount of information that exists about you creates your digital self. Most of these companies know more about us than we know about ourselves. And that's where it starts to get a little scary, because then you can be targeted very easily, because your next move, your actions, your thoughts, your opinions, your attitudes can be predicted. Predictive algorithms, or models as they call them, allow companies or organizations that hold your data to a very high degree of accuracy, know what move you're going to make or know what action you're likely to take off the back of a communication that they send you, because they know just so much about you and your habits and your behavioral data that they are able to predict that. So that's where both, you know, advertising and product development and company strategy starts to become incredibly invasive, where we don't have any protections over deciding who gets access to that volume of information and then what they do with it, of course.
And to your point, Brittany, I have to say, you are so spot on, because not only is it accurate, it makes us predictable. And that's so bizarre to me that we're, you know, this unique mammal on the planet with free choice and free will. And, you know, most of us are act out of integrity and have character. And yet, with about 3 to 5 data points, they know what we're going to do and what we're going to choose and what we're going to buy and what we're going to consume.
And does this, Brittany, does this mean I have to be safe, I need to throw out my Alexa? Tell me it's not so.
Yes.
She even knows my name. I mean, that really startled me, that the second time I asked Alexa, what's the weather, she told me, and then she said, have a nice day, Mike. And I was like, what? So they're collecting data from all this stuff?
Every conversation.
Yeah. Everything that goes on in your home, Alexa is recording. So I wouldn't put one of those in my home if you paid me to do it.
So I have a very scary story about that, because I have a Google Home Assistant that one of my sons gave me for Christmas 2 years ago, because I swore I too would never have some omnipresent recording device, right? So I only use it to play Pandora. That's it. I don't ask it anything. I didn't even know that it had that capacity. So a friend of mine is undergoing radiation, and he was in the kitchen over the weekend with me, and he started getting muscle cramps. And I said, why don't you Google radiation side effects with muscle cramps? And the thing said, okay, here's a link to the Mayo Clinic. Radiation and muscle cramps is a common side effect that is number 4 on the side effects for radiation. And I didn't even ask the question.
And you're right.
Right.
It can be a great tool, but
my God, I'm looking at this thing on my kitchen counter that is now giving me information that I wasn't even asking for.
And you want to know why?
Yeah.
So I suppose everyone that's listening to this, I would love for you to ask yourself a very serious question, which you may have never asked before, which is, have you ever actually read the terms and conditions of an application, or when you're accepting cookies, when you're surfing a new website? Have you ever actually read what you're allowing them to take from you?
Never.
No,
it's like,
we just
it's
say like, accept.
Right.
Yes,
it's like reading your insurance coverage. It's just, I'm not reading 16 pages of legalese.
The terms of arbitration.
I don't understand. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. It's hard to understand by design. This has been made specifically so that you won't read it, or even if you do click on it, you'll get tired of it pretty quickly. And if you decide to read through it, you're still unlikely to actually know what is being collected about you. But if you do decide to go through it and you do have a couple law degrees under your belt, you might realize that you're giving a random application from a company that could be based anywhere in the world with data scientists from anywhere who are working for anybody, getting access to your camera, your pictures, your videos, your microphone that they can turn on your camera and your microphone whenever they'd like, even if you're not using the application. They can get access to all of your contacts, the data that you're creating in other apps, your live location. These are the types of things that we're literally giving to developers all over the world when we have no idea what their intent or purpose is for taking our data if it's not just for user experience on that application. So what we're really doing is signing digital contracts, sometimes hundreds of times per day. And I'm pretty sure that no one listening to this would ever allow someone to come into their office and put a pile of paper contracts on your desk where you flip to the end of every contract and you sign it without reading it. If you wouldn't do that with a paper contract, we should not do that with digital contracts.
I've got to tell you, probably the most disturbing thing that I saw was this, and I think it was in the Great Hack, about the election in Trinidad Tobago, where they ran the Do So campaign to get people not to vote because they knew that a certain group of people were going to vote, and by keeping the other people away from the polls, they accomplished what they wanted, the election of their candidate. I was just horrified by that. You know, as somebody that's out there trying to expand people's right to vote, it's just, it seems there's no end to what people are willing to do. Can you explain to us briefly what Project Alamo was?
Of course. So what I think is very important for everyone to understand is that the amount of data that's usually collected for politics is incredibly significant. And that amount of data that, people who are running elections, whether it be the campaign itself or a data science vendor, they are able to collect enough data in order to put you in certain categories, which is to understand how likely you are to vote, what candidates you're likely to vote for. It's called candidate preference and voter turnout models. And once you can at least understand someone's candidate or party preference and how likely they are to vote, what you can do is find all of the people that are never going to vote for your candidate, but if they do go out to vote, then it's going to be for your opposition. So therefore, you can target people who are not 100% likely to vote. So it's possible for you to discourage them to going to the polls. And that is the only communications that will be sent to those individuals that will definitely support the opposition, but may or may not vote depending on how confident they feel in the opposition candidate. So Project Alamo was the database project for the Trump campaign in 2016. And that consisted of a large amount of Cambridge Analytica data scientists and digital strategists, as well as some people from Brad Parscale's team in San Antonio, some people from Facebook and Twitter, and a variety of other creative groups that were creating as much political content as possible and managing platforms that allowed a single piece of content to be cut 1,000 different ways so that you could show a different campaign to every single group of people you're talking to. And this Project Alamo database specifically showed that there was a very strong group of people that would only ever vote for Hillary Clinton and never for Donald Trump. But the ones that were not definitely likely to vote and could be convinced not to were targeted with a variety of different disinformation campaigns and negative campaigns against Hillary Clinton to undermine those voters' beliefs that she was still a candidate to vote for. Now, no, these people would never vote for Donald Trump, which is what makes this obvious voter suppression campaign. These are not swing voters. Swing voters were always targeted with campaigns that would convince them to vote for Donald Trump as opposed to Hillary Clinton. But the people who were shown to be Hillary Clinton supporters only and would never swing for Donald Trump were labeled as deterrent. So they were only received communications to deter them from wanting to vote at all.
Wow. Well, we got a question from a listener. They've written this question to us, so maybe you can answer this. The person says, it sounds futile to keep yourself out of the data pool. So what can the average person do to protect themselves? What can we do now to protect ourselves as we wait for future legislation?
Well, I think that's one of the most important questions, because I always say that, you know, there are many things that need to happen in parallel to solve the data protection and privacy questions over the long term to make this sustainable. But one, we need the education to protect ourselves and our children. So the digital literacy is actually what my Own Your Data Foundation teaches. So we teach people how to protect themselves online. And that goes in alignment with ongoing laws and regulations that are developing to protect us better. And that also goes in alignment with ethical technology that is privacy by design that gives you more control. So what I really suggest is that while we are waiting for more legislation and regulation, while we are waiting for more technologies to exist that we can use that make it easy and accessible for us to protect our privacy, we need to educate ourselves on what is out there now, what can we do every single day that's going to make a difference. And I would say, first of all, run an experiment and actually read the terms and conditions of an app that you have on your phone that you don't use that often but is always there. Read the terms and conditions of that app and see what you have agreed to give them. And if you are not comfortable with that, delete that app. And do that over and over again as much as you have time for, because I know some of these terms and conditions are 46 pages long and no one has time for that. But run this experiment and start to delete applications off of your devices that you do not need or you are not comfortable with what you are giving away. Secondly, I think it's very important to start thinking about moving off of platforms that have shown to be absolutely negligent in data protection. So I would suggest if you could not have Facebook products on your phone, that would probably clear up a lot of time in your life and also make your data a lot more protected. I don't use, you know, Facebook and stuff on my phone. Instagram and WhatsApp are also owned by Mark Zuckerberg, so remember that. And instead, you could use texting platforms like Signal. Instead of Facebook, you could use data protection social networks like voice.com. Instead of using Google Chrome to search for things, you could use Brave Browser or DuckDuckGo. So little by little, using technology and encryption as activism, you can protect your own data by using products that do not sell your data to other people and that allow you full transparency into what you are agreeing to and protect you in many other ways. Like on voice.com, they don't allow fake accounts because they do a know your customer KYC AML check so that there's no bots and troll farms on this social media account. You also own all of your data and you get paid for content you create in the platform, so it recognizes the value that you are creating with your time, attention, and content production. So there are definitely better choices that are out there, and they're getting bigger by the day. You know, Brave Browser is incredibly popular. DuckDuckGo has been around for a very long time and has always been seen as, you know, the gold standard for for privacy when you're web browsing. So there are options out there. There's also now, instead of these silly Apple devices especially, which sell your data to hundreds or thousands of companies every single minute, there's now something called a Clear Phone, where it protects all of your data and blocks advertisements and pop-ups and any targeting and tracking. If there's an advertisement that's supposed to be in an article, it just says advertisement, and you don't actually see anything in that box. It's really amazing. So there are new products that are out there, and I really think that if you really care about your data and your privacy, and everybody should, then starting to migrate to platforms that respect your privacy is the best form of activism every single day, but it's not the only thing you can do. The digital literacy programs that I teach at the Own Your Data Foundation is a new IEEE global standard called DQ, and DQ stands for digital intelligence quotient. So like IQ or EQ, it's your DQ score. And over the past 10 years, a lot of the world's most technologically advanced universities, departments of innovation and technology, and ministries from different governments, a lot of the best think tanks and advocacy organizations came up with this indicator set, which gives you this DQ score. And it includes everything from understanding what your data rights are or what they should be, basic cybersecurity protocols, media literacy, which I think is one of the most important things you could learn these days, so you can spot fake news and disinformation and hacking and phishing attempts. And then how do you use emotional intelligence on social media and the internet when interacting with other people? How do you stop from getting addicted to your devices so you can protect your mental and physical health while leading a digital life? These are all the different components of an educational curriculum, which is now going to be implemented in schools all around the world over the coming years. But it's something that none of us grew up with. So in the meantime, we have to help people break all of their bad habits and start to get adults on board for this, so that when our kids are much more savvy at protecting their privacy than we are, we're a little bit more in alignment.
So may I share with you about that, the nefariousness of it? Brittany, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, but doing my studies on big data, where you go, what you look, what you click, and as you mentioned, how long you linger and what captures your attention is compiled. And so somebody was looking for a deep fryer to give their aunt for a birthday present. So they were clicking, right? Well, an insurance company got that information and ascertained that they had an unhealthy lifestyle, because if you're deep frying foods, it's likely that you're overweight or you're going to get diabetes or you have a shortened lifespan. So that those clicks were used against the consumer, and it wasn't even the target. It was what they were doing and where they were going. And so there's a difference between activism and clicktivism. Could you share with our listeners what that means?
Absolutely. So I think it's so important what you just said, and it's actually one of the biggest legislative topics that's going on in America right now, which is purpose limitation. If you are going to collect data about us, what purpose are you collecting it for? What is it going to be used for? It needs to have a limited purpose. So, for instance, in the state of California, Prop 24, which is on the ballot there this November, and I highly endorse, is an update to CCPA that specifically concentrates on purpose limitation and also assisting small and medium-sized companies with compliance with California Data Protection Agency that actually will hopefully have 50 staff members to help companies that are limited on their capacity to comply to actually make sure that they understand what they need to do and help them implement that. So when we talk about purpose limitation, I think one of the best examples that I can give you, besides the one that you just gave, is a component of a law that I helped write earlier this year. That's the first coronavirus contact tracing data protection act. And that is just passed Senate committee in the state of New York. And what we wrote in there for purpose limitation was that if you are collecting data for contact tracing for public health to stem the spread of coronavirus, then you cannot, for instance, share that data with law enforcement that could then be used to track peaceful protesters and or target people in any other manner, right? And so limiting the purpose just for public health allows for people to be much more comfortable with sharing their data in order to save human life. I think we all agree that if we could share safely and securely anonymized data sets about our locations and whether or not we've had coronavirus and when, in order to stop people from getting sick, of course everyone would do that. But too many people are scared that they don't know what else that data is going to be used for, and I completely agree with them. I would not use a contact tracing app at all, and in fact, I just switched from my Apple phone to a Clear phone so that when I, because I was being forced to update my Apple phone and it was going to have automatic contact tracing on there. And I don't believe in that. I think until, and everyone that has recently updated their iPhone, guess what? The Apple-Google collaboration with the government means that we absolutely have been tricked into giving away all of our location data on the premise that we're going to prevent coronavirus. But I think we've seen that the efforts in the U.S. have been, you know, pretty poor as of right now. So I don't think at this point we're going to stop coronavirus with contact tracing. And I would not recommend anyone opt into contact tracing until we have regulated it properly.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, and before I ask my next question, can you give us your website for Own Your Own Data, for the Own Your Own Data Foundation, in case people want to find out more or they want to contribute to your great work? What's your website?
Or buy the book.
Of course.
Or buy the book.
That is ownyourdata.foundation. And we would absolutely love all of the support. We're trying to get this program into as many American schools as possible. What me and my foundation do is we teach parents and teachers in order to help their kids through the DQ curriculum. So we do training of trainers, and we help schools to implement this. We do school assembly talks. We do teacher training. We do parent-teacher conferences. And then we also have a program of mentorship for children so that the kids who are most excited about learning this can also help their peers. So I think the faster that we're able to put this into schools, the more we can assure ourselves that the next generation is not going to be in the same vulnerable situation that the rest of us are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just amazed. I don't think my children, now they're adults, but I don't think they even watch TV. I think they get everything off
the internet. They cut the cord.
Yeah, it's just amazing. But let me ask you, do you own the data? When I contract with Cambridge Analytica or whoever these days, when I contract with them, then do I own the data? Are political parties, now that the genie is out of the bottle, are they constructing their own databases with this information? Because that's what we used to do in direct mail, right? We'd get you as a donor, and then we would construct a profile of you once you gave to us one time. Are political parties going to do this? You think they're doing this now?
Absolutely. And some of the most powerful databases that exist right now are, you know, the Republican and Democrat Party historical databases. Because the more that you have historic data and can show behavioral patterns, the easier it is to predict what people will do in the future. And that was, I suppose, one of the biggest controversies around Cambridge Analytica as well, is that it was not just one campaign or one political party. It was contracting to do data projects with everyone from, you know, candidates to the NRA to commercial companies. And that meant the database was ultimately much more powerful than a single entity because it was collecting data from so many different campaigns, so many different advertising initiatives, so many different pieces of research and political polling that it meant the amount of information in that database was one of the biggest databases on Americans that had ever existed at the time, as far as I knew, and therefore the predictions were a lot more accurate. And therefore, it was much easier to persuade or manipulate, which I think is nearly the same context, much easier to persuade people or manipulate them into doing whatever the person with holding the money wants them to do.
So, Brittany, could you share with our listeners that Michael, this editor, just asked the question about your website. You talk about democratizing digital intelligence. What does that actually mean? And is it not too late? We've already opened up the barn door.
So I'll take those two separately, which is one, I just want to always say that it's never too late to do what's right. And also for data science, the most important data is new data. If you start protecting all the data that you create from here into the future, then you become a lot less predictable, you become less accessible, and you can save your important data to share with organizations that you care about or for purposes that you believe are going to make a positive impact in the world. I really, you know, I don't like to scare people into thinking that you need to keep all your data private. What I really advocate for is that we create a legislative and regulatory structure, an educational system, and the technology to back all of that up to make sure that all of us can feel safe and comfortable that if we wanted to share our data, then we could do that safely and we would know where it's going, what it's going to be used for, and that if it's going to be monetized, that we would get some sort of compensation for that. And that's really what I see as the biggest opportunity, because really, artificial intelligence, data science, robotics, these technologies are going to solve a lot of the world's greatest problems if we allow innovation to still happen. If we overregulate on behalf of privacy, then we're unlikely to cure cancer or diabetes. We're unlikely to stop the next mass shooting or terrorist attack. We need to find ways of sharing data, but we need to make sure that there's transparency into what's being collected, that we have opt-in and consent mechanisms and permission structures to say what we are comfortable with, what we will allow. And if that data is going to be monetized, and here's the biggest opportunity, if that data is going to be monetized, that we can get a dividend. Because right now, when we have 30% unemployment rates, where we have entire industries crumbling, where we have the mass eradication of small and medium-sized companies, the future of work and employment is going to look very different than what it has looked like in the past. We need to find a way to make sure that every American and every person on planet Earth really has a way of at minimum meeting their basic needs every single day. So it's possible that if we start having rights over our data, that we would at minimum be able to feed ourselves and our families every single day off of the compensation that we get from this multi-trillion dollar industry. So that's
wow.
That's the big picture. You know, data becoming the great equalizer and a way for us to ensure our own human rights. And that's why I really fight for this. I'm not fighting for privacy. I'm fighting for data protection and data rights. So if you want to keep something private, you have the right to do it. But if you want to, for instance, share your medical data with healthcare researchers, then you can do that too without being afraid that it's going to be used to target you, right? And that's really where I'm going with all of this. And I think a lot of people, especially during this pandemic, can start to see the real value in that conversation.
Well, believe it or not, we're running out of time here, and there's so much more to talk about. I hope that sometime in the future, Brittany, you'll come back, and maybe after the election, and we can talk more about this. I think you've been an incredible guest. We thank you so much for being on the show. I've got a hammer in my right hand, and I'm gonna walk right upstairs and smack my Alexa right on the head.
Well, what about
head.
That watch?
Oh, I can't the give up the watch yet.
Keeping track of everything.
I have to read
your REM sleep and all of that stuff. Ridiculous. But Brittany, you, instead of doom and gloom, which I was afraid we were going to have a conversation about, you have provided hope. And I have been withdrawing consciously, but the fact that you said that new data is what everyone is aggregating, right? So the less data that we provide, even though we may have shared pictures of our kids or whatever on social media, means that we're less relevant. and we're less of a target and we're less monetized.
Correct. Absolutely. And so it's about empowering us to make that choice. If we want to share the data and we have some sort of incentive to do so, then great. You know, I talk with healthcare researchers that say it's so hard to get data that they can't create the right medicines to solve medical problems because they have the data of 18 to 35 year old young white boys in college who want some beer money. They don't have access to females and minorities, our data set, so that they can create medicines that work for everybody. And if you were to give 6 to 8 weeks of your data to a diabetes study, that's worth $28,000 to a diabetes research organization. So start to think about the ability to monetize our data and to be able to share our data for positive impact. It really is a very practical way for us to move forward over the coming years in terms of how do we show people who are working on protecting and rebuilding our economy that there is a reason to give us data rights. We're not here to shut down the technology industries. We're not here to blow up social media companies. It's not about that. It's about changing the incentive structure so that we all are actually receiving value for the value that we are creating every single day. It will bring more equality, more ability for us to protect our rights, and definitely a brighter future for everybody.
And we have to give a plug to your book, Targeted, the Cambridge Analytica Whistleblower's Inside Story of How Big Data, Trump, and Facebook Broke Democracy and How It Can Happen Again.
Yes, please get the book, watch the movie. And thank you again, Brittany.
Unbelievable, Kaiser. Brittany. Thank you so much.
You've been great. And, you know, we end each show with a song, and this goes out to all the Facebook users. And also to our great guest, Brittany Kaiser. This is the Monkees with I'm a Believer. Thank you, Brittany.
And thank you to our listeners, as always.
I thought love was only true in fairy tales. And for someone else, but not for me. Give the people their right to vote.